tilting from side to side in the nearby slips, the ferry's horn sounds, and seagulls cry out like jealous girls. Tommy the bartender pops the cork on their bottle of champagne. "Celebrating, ladies?" he asks. Amy hasn't thought about the optics of this until now. She's taking a day off work so she can mourn her boyfriend's ex-wife, but her version of mourning is drinking champagne she can't afford and eating caviar she really can't afford. What if someone sees her? "That's right," Lorna says, raising her flute of platinum bubbles. "Celebrating a life." Amy had offered to skip the service and reception before JP even asked. "I think everyone, the kids especially, would be more comfortable if I stayed away." Amy sensed JP's relief immediately.
"You're probably right," he said.
"Will the kids miss her? Carson, maybe. But if Amy attended the service, everyone would be watching her because she would be in the uniquely awful position of mourning a woman she had not always spoken of in the most generous of terms. Amy couldn't bear the scrutiny. She raises her flute and clinks it against Lorna's without words. All she wants to do today is drink and forget. At some point in the future, JP will be able to think about something other than Vivi's death. The summer will march on, the kids will adjust, Leo will leave for college. Amy will reach out to Carson. This might be a chance for them to grow closer. And JP will be free to propose. Amy just has to wait a little longer. The champagne is gone before they know it, and Lorna orders a bottle of rosé. Tommy asks if they're thinking about more food. The oysters slipped down Amy's throat in 6 briny swallows, and the caviar provided 3 bites apiece. Amy orders 2 buttery lobster rolls with fries. She turns to Lorna.
"Don't worry, this is all my treat."
She does some mental calculations and realizes that even if they stop eating and drinking now, their bill will be $400. This lunch is extravagant, but she has reached the point of no return.
"We could be dead tomorrow."
As the afternoon wears on, the bar becomes more crowded. The demographic is handsome men, suntanned after a day of sailing or fishing, in groups of 3 or 4. One cute guy in a Torrey Pines visor starts chatting with Lorna. He likes her accent, he says. His grandfather was an Irishman, from Wexford.
"Ha," Lorna says, "that's where I grew up."
Amy tries to contribute to their conversation, piping up in her own accent, "Alabama." But her southern drawl has dried up in the past 10 years, and now when she says, "y'all," it sounds forced. She turns to the remaining warm rosé in her glass and wills one of the other gentlemen to come over and rescue her. But nobody does. She arrived on Nantucket a svelte 23-year-old. Now she's 10 years older and 20 pounds heavier, and she looks worn out. She is worn out. Dealing with JP and his kids and his mother and his struggle to find himself has been exhausting. And wondering when she will stop being the girlfriend, mistress, and start being the wife has left her disenchanted. Her light has dimmed. No wonder all the men at this bar are steering clear of her. She might as well have a sticker across her forehead that says, "Used up." She throws back some more wine just as a man in a white undershirt and a pair of tight gray suit pants takes the stool to her left. He signals the bartender, orders a Cisco whale's tail, and only then seems to notice Amy.
"Oops, the seat taken?"
Amy shakes her head. She's happy that there's someone in this bar who doesn't think she's a leper, even if he's not one of the gorgeous sailing men. Amy didn't get a good look at the guy, and she's afraid to turn her head, lest she seem too obvious, though she does notice blood on his knuckles. She's had so much to drink that she thinks nothing of grabbing the guy's wrist.
"Did you hurt yourself? Or were you in a fight?"
"Fight," the guy says.
His beer arrives and he stands up and throws back the whole thing in one long gulp. This gives Amy a chance to look at him. When he finishes, He takes a long look at her.
Oh, he says. Hey, Amy.
Dennis, she says.
Her voice sounds enthusiastic, which is strange because she doesn't know Dennis very well. He was Vivi's boyfriend, although Amy heard from JP that apparently Vivi and Dennis had broken up or were breaking up in stages. Amy owes Dennis a debt of gratitude. Last June, at Willa and Rip's wedding, JP and Vivi had danced together to the first song along with Willa and Rip and Mr. and Mrs. Bonham. It was at the top of Amy's worst moments of the relationship. Vivi fit right into JP's arms, and they danced so fluidly. Hadn't JP told Amy the very first summer that Vivi couldn't dance? And they were laughing and so visibly joyful that Amy thought, what am I even doing here? She might have left the Field and Ore Club altogether had Dennis not come over to her with a fresh drink, had he not rested his hand lightly on her back and clinked a cheers and whispered a joke in her ear that she hadn't been able to hear over the music, but laughed at anyway.
I'll have another,
Dennis says to the bartender now. So wait, you were at the memorial service, right? And the reception? Dennis nods. If he's here at crew, then the reception must be over. Amy wonders if JP has called. She wonders if he missed her, if she did the right thing by staying away. She wants to know if anyone asked where she was. She is hopelessly self-centered, she realizes. Today has nothing to do with her. Today is about Vivi and the people she loved and the people who loved her, which leaves Amy out. Poor Dennis. Amy tries to imagine how he must feel. Vivi broke up with him and then died. It's two completely different kinds of pain, one layered on top of the other. How are you doing? Amy asks. Dennis shrugs. How are the kids?
I didn't talk to the kids. They were up front with Savannah and your boyfriend.
Oh, Savannah, Amy says. She must be really upset.
She is. She gave one hell of a speech at the church.
Amy wishes she'd been there to hear it. She has always been slightly obsessed with Savannah. Savannah Hamilton has that elusive thing known as class. It's visible from every angle. It's her hair, her clothes, her manner of speaking, her graciousness, her taste, her effortlessness in the world. Why has she never married? Amy asked JP this once, and he said,
her standards are too high.
She dated Michael Del Rey, a bigwig at JP Morgan, for a while, Amy knew, but broke up with him because he was too mercenary. Savannah is a do-gooder. She took her family money and started a nonprofit that feeds and educates children in places like Niger and Bangladesh. Even if Amy wanted to hate her, she couldn't.
So did you get into a fight at the funeral? Amy asks.
The reception.
You got into a fist fight at the Field and Ore Club?
Amy is titillated by the mere thought. The club intimidates her. JP always talked about how Vivi used to flout the club rules, so every time Amy sets foot in the place, she feels the stifling need to behave. Amy doesn't belong there any more than Vivi did. Amy hails from Potter, Alabama. People know Montgomery and Mobile, but no one has ever heard of Potter. It's as country as catfish.
I did.
Did they throw you out?
They did.
Who'd you fight with?
Dennis brings his second beer to his mouth and drains half in one swallow.
Who do you think?
Amy stares at the puddle of pink wine left in her lipstick-smudged glass.
JP?
Yep.
Amy takes stock of her surroundings. Lorna's in deep conversation with the sailor. Amy can easily leave her here if she wants to go home and tend to JP. If there's blood on Dennis's knuckles, what must JP's face look like?
Is he badly hurt?
He might have a shiner, Dennis says. I hit him twice. He didn't really fight back.
No, he wouldn't, Amy thinks. JP doesn't like confrontation. If he has a problem, he throws money at it. She should probably go home and tend to his wounds, but she doesn't want to.
I had a lot of pent-up anger toward the guy, Dennis says, though I feel bad about hitting him now.
He eyes Amy's glass.
What if I bought you an apology drink for ruining your boyfriend's face?
I wouldn't say no, Amy says. The Chief. The national average of hit-and-run homicides that end in convictions is under 50%. But that doesn't make the chief feel any better. Nor does the fact that his wife, Andrea, spent an hour on Thursday watching the virtual memorial service for Vivian Howe, then spent another hour, or more, on the Vivian Howe Memorial Facebook page, reading through the comments from her readers. They want the Nantucket police to figure out who did it, Andrea says. They want justice. I feel shady. There I was on the page, posing as a normal, everyday reader, which I am, except that I'm also married to the Nantucket chief of police.
I'm doing the best I can, Ed says. But the truth is, he's getting nowhere with this investigation.
The tire tracks were no help. The pattern had been compromised by Cruz's footprints, the arrival of the ambulance, and the footprints of the paramedics. Lisa Hitt found Vivian Howe's blood on Cruz DeSantis's car, on the door handle. Likely, Cruz had Vivi's blood on his hands when he climbed into his Jeep after the ambulance took her to the hospital. The luminol turned up nothing on the bumper or grill, which was a relief, though frankly, the chief would have felt better if the car were completely clean. He doesn't want the statement, Vivian Howe's blood was on Cruz DeSantis's Jeep, to get out into the community without context. Already, Falco's report of seeing the kid run a stop sign and speed down Surfside is everywhere. Finn told the chief he'd heard people talking about it on the beach at Cisco.
They're all saying Cruz hit her, Finn said. There's no evidence of that, the chief said. People talk. We might as well call this Rumor Island.
The only member of Vivian Howe's family who is called Ed is Rip Bonham, her son-in-law. The chief knows Rip and his father, Chas, and his sister, Pamela Bonham Bridgman, because the department works with the Bonhams Insurance Company on regular traffic accidents. Rip's phone call was gentle, just asking if the police had any leads. The next steps would be examining Vivi's clothes for flecks of paint from the Jeep, and looking for fibers from those clothes on Cruz's bumper. Every contact leaves a trace. Here is where the investigation hit a major snafu. Vivi's clothes are missing. The ME says he followed protocol. He cut the clothes off the deceased, bagged them, and had them delivered to the police station, where they would be processed and sent to Lisa Hitt on the Cape. But the clothes never made it to the station. According to Alexis Lepresti, who was working the processing desk, the chief went back to the ME. The guy was new, replacing longtime ME Dr. Fields, to ask who exactly he'd sent to deliver the clothes. And the ME admitted he wasn't sure. He'd handed them off and assumed they would be dealt with.
Well, where are they then? The chief said.
He was about to blow his stack, but the last thing he needed was an ME with a grudge against him.
Never mind, they must be at the station.
Ed drove to work and stormed up to Alexis Lepresti at the processing desk.
You did not see or receive the bag containing Vivian Howe's clothes from the hospital, is that correct?
Nope, Alexis said. Did you check the evidence room?
Yes, he said, twice. Who was on the schedule last Saturday?
Alexis looked put out by this question. I don't know. The chief was tempted to fire her on the spot. She must have noticed his expression because she clickety-clacked on her computer and said, Dixon and Pitcher. Pitcher was green. He'd been on the force for only 9 months. It was entirely possible Pitcher had left the clothes in the back of his squad car. When the chief called Pitcher, there was loud music and laughing in the background. It sounded like he was out on the town. He was very young. The chief remembered that he'd seen Pitcher hanging around Alexis Lepresti's desk with unusual frequency, probably trying to get a date.
Pitcher said that he hadn't been the one to pick up the clothes. I definitely would have remembered that. Clothes and running shoes too, right? Right, the chief said. So you did see them? No, Pitcher said. But I know she got hit while running. So there would have been running shoes. What I'm saying is, shoes would have been hard to miss. In a last-ditch effort, the chief called Lisa Hitt to see if, maybe by the grace of God, the clothes had landed in her hands. No, she said. Why? Are they missing? The chief can't release Cruz's car until they find the clothes, and he knows he owes Joe DeSantis an explanation, one that should be offered in person. He swings by the Nickel at 2:30, after the lunch crowd has dispersed. He's relieved to find only Joe in the place, slicing up a prime rib in the back. When Joe sees the chief, a concerned look crosses his face, but he smiles.
The tuna niçoise baguette is sold out, Ed. Sorry. You know you gotta get here earlier than this.
Ed's stomach rumbles. He could do with a prime rib sliced thin, lacy Swiss, and arugula with some of Joe's wickedly spicy horseradish sauce on a warm pretzel roll. But that's not why he's here. There are days he hates his job, and he has just lived through a handful of them.
Do you have a minute, Joe?
Joe strides across the shop, flips the sign to say closed, and pulls two Cokes out of the cooler. There's nowhere to sit, so they lean on the counter.
If you're not here for lunch, there must be trouble.
The chief sighs.
Has Cruz talked to you at all about what happened when he found Vivian Howe?
Joe shakes his head, cracks open his Coke.
He hasn't said a word about it except that he told you everything.
Joe takes a drink.
I guess I don't understand why you still have his car. There are a few things that look bad, the chief says. One of the officers saw him run the stop sign at Hooper Farm and Surfside, and then haul ass down Surfside only a few minutes before he called 911.
Joe is silent.
When I asked Cruz where he was coming from, he said home, which doesn't match up. Your officer is sure it was him? There are a lot of white Jeeps on this island, Ed. The officer said it was him, though he could have been mistaken.
The chief cracks open his own can of Coke and tries to enjoy the first cold, spicy sip.
The tire tracks were no help. Luminol turned up Ms. Howe's blood on the door handle, but not on the bumper or grill. And because of the gash on Ms. Howe's leg, there would almost definitely be blood on the bumper. Cruz didn't hit her.
Joe says,
that child.
Joe spins the can in his hands.
He doesn't lie, Ed. If he'd hit Vivi, he would have told us. Why was he going over to the house place so early on a Saturday morning?
The chief says,
7:15? I asked him, but he didn't answer.
Joe says,
I take it he and Leo had a fight. Something must have gone down the night before. That happens around graduation. Emotions are high. People say things they don't mean. Cruz hasn't seen Leo since the hospital. I could barely get him to go to the memorial service. Cruz was very emotional at the station, and I wondered if something else was going on, the chief says. Vivian Howe was, for all intents and purposes, Cruz's mother. He loved her.
Joe clears his throat.
Vivi was very good about making him feel like a part of things. About taking care of him the way only a mom can. Vivi's death is a big loss to my boy, and to me as well. But Ed, he didn't hit her. Okay. You're not convinced?
Joe straightens to his full height, and suddenly the room grows smaller.
You think he's hiding something? Lying to you? He has a lot to lose. Damn straight he has a lot to lose,
Joe says.
The kid has achieved beyond anyone's wildest dreams. I don't understand why Cruz is being treated like a suspect rather than a heartbroken kid who happened to be the first one to find the woman. Or is he a suspect because he's black, and when someone black is close to the scene of a crime, he must have committed it?
The chief recoils.
This isn't about race, he says.
He sits with his discomfort and checks himself.
Did Falco actually see Cruz? Or was there some other black kid driving a white Jeep? Did Falco notice Cruz primarily because he was black? Was it easier for the Nantucket community to say that Cruz DeSantis did a bad thing because he was black? The chief will not lead a department where black citizens are treated differently than white. He has learned, however, that racism is systemic. It's often so deeply buried that you can't even see it, but it's there.
I like you, Ed. I count you as a friend. I would never take advantage of that friendship. But my son didn't hit Vivi. He's the kind of kid who would have confessed right away and presented his wrists for the cuffs. He loved Vivi Howe so much that he would never forgive himself. Now, I know there's something unresolved between him and Leo Quinborough. I can see that on his face without even asking. But what I don't see is guilt over killing a woman. He has been very patient while you check his car. He's been riding his old bike to work without complaint because he trusts the system. But I'm not going to stand by and let you make him a scapegoat because you need a conviction in this case. Cruz didn't hit her, Ed.
These words land, and in that instant, the chief knows in his heart that Cruz DeSantis didn't hit the woman. Someone else hit her and ran, probably only a few seconds before Cruz found her.
I'll release the car this afternoon, the chief says. Thank you, Ed, Joe says,
and the men shake hands. Vivi is relaxing on the velvet chaise when Martha enters through the green door, holding her clipboard. There are some lovely posts on your memorial Facebook page, she says. Would you like to take a look? Are they all lovely? Vivi asks. If there's one thing she's learned about Facebook, it's that people think it's just fine to post things that they would never dream of saying to someone's face. In recent years, Vivi had become something of an online manners stickler. If you don't have something nice to say, keep scrolling. Well, Martha says. Vivi's interest is piqued. She takes the clipboard. Vivian Howe Memorial Facebook page. Please share your thoughts and memories of Vivian Howe below. We encourage you all to stay positive. Vivian's family and close friends will look at this page as a way to seek solace from her readers. Thank you. This past winter, I was diagnosed with stage 2 triple positive intraductal carcinoma and underwent 18 rounds of chemotherapy at MD Anderson in Houston. I brought a Vivian Howe novel to each of my 3-hour appointments. My chemo nurses always asked how I was enjoying the book, and this gave us something to chat about other than my cancer. I will always be grateful to Vivian Howe for being with me in my darkest hours. Krista J., Katy, Texas. Vivian Howe is a queen. Rest in peace, Vivi. Megan R., Wiscasset, Maine. I don't even want to read Golden Girl because when I do, I won't have any more Vivi to read, and that's when the loss of her will sink in. Is anyone else feeling that way? Laurette A., Beaumont, Scotland. Reply, me too, Taffy H., Kalamazoo, Michigan. Reply, me too, high fives emoji, Beth H., Sharon, Massachusetts. So far, so good, Vivi says. Hello. While I'm sad about the loss of one of my favorite authors, I would also like to offer a suggestion. Please will someone go back into Ms. Howe's novels and fix the copy editing mistakes? On page 201, line 21 of The Photographer, it says Truman, where it should say Davis. Also, I've long been shocked that the copy editor let the interrobang stay throughout Ms. Howe's work. For those of you who don't know, an interrobang is an unorthodox combination of question mark and exclamation point. How did this happen? Question mark, exclamation, exclamation, exclamation point, question, question, question mark. You can see from my example how unseemly this looks. Thank you, and my sympathies to the family. Pauline F., Homestead, Florida. Reply,
Interrobang sounds like what happens when one of my kids knocks on the door while I'm having sex with my husband. Sorry, couldn't resist. I like to think this is a Vivi-type joke. Carrie H., Grand Island, Nebraska. She's right, Vivi says. That is the kind of joke I would make. Martha says nothing.
Hello. I'm new to Facebook as of right this minute. I was wondering if anyone knows how to get a hold of someone in Vivi's family. I'm not some weirdo stalker, I promise. I went to Parma High School with Vivi from 1983 to 1987. She was my girlfriend for 11 months. I haven't seen her since August of 87, but I heard from the sister of my former bandmate that she passed away suddenly, and I'd like to express my condolences and share my memories with the family. I also just found out that she's a writer, and kind of famous. I don't read much. I went on Amazon and read the description of her book that's coming out next month, and I would like to talk to her family about that as well. So if anyone here can help, I'd appreciate it. I don't have a Facebook page. This is my coworker's page I'm writing from now. But my name is Brett Caspian, and I'm the GM of the Holiday Inn by the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. You can call the front desk and ask for me. I'm sorry about Vivi. She was a special girl.
Oh, no, Vivi thinks. No! Brett Caspian found out about the book.
Vivi's hunch had been correct. Brett didn't know she was a writer. He knows now only because someone told him she died. His bandmate's sister. Roy's sister, Renata, if Vivi had to guess.
Ah.
She realizes how naive she was to think that Brett would never hear about this book. The whole world is connected. Everybody knows everything, thanks to the internet. Brett isn't on Facebook, but that doesn't mean he lives in a cabin in the woods or in the middle of the Brazilian rainforest. He's the GM at a Holiday Inn in Knoxville, Tennessee. This seems so random. If Vivi had to guess what Brett was doing with his life, she would have said he was working on a production crew, doing lights and sound for the bands they'd loved. Foreigner, Blue Oyster Cult, on their summer outdoor venue reunion tours. Brett doesn't sound angry in the message. He doesn't sound like he hates her. But he will, if he reads Golden Girl. Vivi remembers how Brett used to wait on a bench and smoke every time she went into B. Dalton at the Parmatown Mall. He wouldn't even set foot in the bookstore. There's no way he'll read Golden Girl. Vivi hands the clipboard back to Martha with a smile. Better than I expected, she says. Willa. Willa and Rip are moving for the summer. They're leaving their house on Quaker Road, purchased just after their wedding with help from the Elder Bonhams, for a cottage situated on the beach at the entrance to Smith's Point. Their house on Quaker Road is 4,500 square feet and has 5 bedrooms. The cottage is tiny. It's a dollhouse. It used to be the summer residence for Rip's grandparents, and Willa and Rip would ride their bikes there when they were in middle school and high school. Rip's grandmother would serve them lemonade garnished with fresh mint, but they had to drink it at the picnic table on the deck because the house was too small for them all to hang out inside. The cottage is called Wee Bit. It has a teensy tiny sitting room, one wall of which is a galley kitchen, a bedroom that is big enough to hold one bed and one nightstand, and a powder room with a sink and toilet. There's a deck with a picnic table and a gas grill that Rip's grandfather splurged on sometime in the mid-1990s, and 3 stairs down, there's a flagstone patio in front of an outdoor shower. Beyond the deck and the shower are dunes, with a path that cuts over and onto the beach. After Rip's grandparents went into assisted living, Wee Bit sat unused. Nobody in the Bonham family wanted to stay there. They were a tall family. Chaz and Rip couldn't even stand to their full height unless they were right in the center of the room where the ceiling peaked. Both of Rip's grandparents passed away over that winter, and Rip officially inherited the cottage. It was infested with mice and everything was mildewed. The floor in the sitting room was rotted. The bathroom was unspeakable. Willa thought that they could, maybe, use the cottage as a staging area if they ever wanted to throw a beach party, but Rip was set on living there. Without telling Willa, Rip had hired Vivi's contractor, Marky Mark, to replace the floors, repaint, tile the powder room, and update the appliances in the kitchen. Three-quarter fridge, miniature stovetop and oven, microwave. And he'd bought a new bed, a queen instead of a king, so there was marginally more room to move around. He also bought an AC unit. Marky Mark rebuilt the enclosure around the outdoor shower. Rip picked out a new love seat, seagrass rugs, a round wooden coffee table. When he took Willa to look at it, saying only that he'd spruced it up, she had been blown away. It was so much better. It was adorable, like something from the HGTV show Tiny Paradise. It was still way too small to live in. After Willa's second miscarriage, she started to change her mind about that. And after her third, she was counting the days until they could move out of the house on Quaker and into Wee Bit. The house on Quaker was enormous, the rooms yawning and empty, waiting to be filled with children. The house was tapping its foot like an impatient friend. "What's taking you so long? What's wrong with you?" They move out to Wee Bit exactly 1 week after Vivi's memorial service. Willa is even happier to escape the house now because all she sees is the ghost of her mother dropping by with banana bread or a bunch of chives from her herb garden or a book that she wants Willa to read so they can discuss it. Her mother never called or even texted before she popped by, which was fine most of the time. Once, back in February, Vivi let herself into the house while Willa and Rip were in the bedroom having sex. They'd heard her calling out, they'd heard her climbing the stairs, and Rip had nearly lost his erection, but Willa begged him to finish because she was ovulating and he had paddle tennis that night, and by the time he got home, she would be asleep. Rip said, "She's going to come into the bedroom, Will, and the door isn't locked." Willa had shouted, "Go away, Mom, please, we're busy." "Getting busy?" Vivi said. "Sorry, guys, have fun." They could hear her retreat, and Rip came, then fell on top of Willa, saying, "That was the ultimate test of my manhood." And a couple of weeks later, Willa discovered she was pregnant. They called it the bad timing baby until Willa started bleeding at 8 weeks. Vivi stopped by so often because, Willa realized tearfully, the two of them had become friends. They'd emerged out of the dark, confusing tunnel maze of mother-daughter relationships to discover that they liked each other and had fun hanging out. Vivi hadn't enjoyed a friendship with her own mother at all. They remained in the maze until Nancy Howe died during Vivi's first winter on Nantucket. Vivi admitted to Willa recently that she had been worried when she gave birth to a girl because her own relationship with her mother had been so unpleasant. "Then I realized I didn't have to do things the way my mother did them. I could become the mother I wish I'd had." Vivi laughed. "Your father and I quickly figured out that you were going to raise us rather than the other way around." Yes, much has been made of the way Willa is. A super achiever, responsible, reliable, mature, a leader. She's the youngest assistant director the Nantucket Historical Association has ever had, and she will take over there in 5 years when the present director retires. She'll be executive director before she turns 30. Or she might leave the NHA once she gets pregnant and work on her pet project, a biography of Anna Gardner, a Nantucket abolitionist who'd organized 3 anti-slavery conventions in the early 1840s. Frederick Douglass spoke at all 3. In their conversations at the kitchen island, Willa drinking herbal tea and Vivi drinking tequila over ice, Willa kept a bottle of Casa Dragones on hand just for her mother, they would talk about what path Willa's life might take. Vivi was of the opinion that Willa could have it all. She could work at the NHA for 35 years and leave her stamp on the historical legacy of the island, and she could write the biographies of Anna Gardner, Eunice Ross, and any other remarkable and overlooked Nantucket woman that she wanted to. She could ask for a sabbatical, or she could set up flex time.
What about kids?
Willa said. She wanted 5, 4 at the very least, but every time she said this, Vivi groaned and said she'd feel differently about having 5 after the first one was born.
You'll get a nanny, Vivi said,
and unlike me, you'll use your time to write. I used the times when I had babysitters to clean or take a nap. Kids are hard, Willie, I won't lie. Willa can see her mother clearly, her stylish dark pixie cut, her brown eyes, the freckles across her nose, her dangly earrings. She wore clothes that were meant for a person 20 years younger, but that looked good on Vivi. Tight white t-shirts, skinny jeans, suede high-heeled boots. Willa was hesitant to use the word beautiful to describe her mother because it didn't quite fit. She was cute, spunky, alive, and she had near-perfect instincts about people. If her mother believed Willa could do it all, then it was so. Where does Willa see herself 5 years from now, at age 29? She is the executive director of the NHA, and she has just published her biography of Anna Gardner to great critical acclaim. Even her fantasy does not include the book becoming a commercial success. She has 3 children, Charles Evan Bonham III, Charlie, age 5, Lucinda Vivian, Lucy, age 4.5, and Edward William, Teddy, age 3. Charlie is in kindergarten and the other 2 go to Montessori preschool, leaving Willa free to split her days between work on NHA business and her second book, which is about Eunice Ross, the young black woman who petitioned for entry into Nantucket High School in 1847, nearly a century before Brown v. Board of Education. She picks the kids up from school and fixes them a snack of freshly baked banana bread. Then they have quiet time doing puzzles and reading while Willa makes dinner. Tonight, it's grilled steak tips, Parmesan fondant potatoes, pan-roasted asparagus, a crisp green salad, and popovers. And for dessert, a strawberry rhubarb galette. Rip comes home from work and changes into the soft gray Amherst t-shirt that Willa loves. He kisses Willa long and deep, the way he used to when they were in junior high. Then he puts his finger to her lips and says, "We'll finish that later." After dinner, Rip gives the kids a bath, puts them in their pajamas, and supervises teeth brushing while Willa cleans the kitchen, makes lunches for the following day, and gets the dishwasher humming. Then she goes in to read to the kids, 3 books per night, chosen by theme. Tonight's theme is pigs. If you give a pig a pancake, Olivia saves the circus, and Toot and Puddle. After the children are tucked in and on their way to dreamland, Willa and Rip reunite in front of the TV. Willa in a silk nightie because she's lost all the baby weight and then some. She gets up before dawn to ride her Peloton on Tuesdays and Thursdays. That's all it takes. Rip cracks open a beer and pours Willa a glass of the Cloudy Bay Sauvignon Blanc. They start watching the first episode of the hot new show on Peacock, but before they can figure out who the main characters are, they're all over each other on the sofa. And the silent furtiveness of it, they can't wake the children, makes it just as hot as the sex used to be in high school when they were under a blanket on the sofa in Rip's basement rec room. After that, sweaty and spent, they split a piece of the strawberry rhubarb galette dolloped with freshly whipped cream and then decide that sleep is more important than finishing the show. They head to the bedroom. Willa picks up the novel on her nightstand, and Rip is snoring before she turns the page. When Willa reaches up to turn off the light, she feels a tiny burst of light and energy inside of her, and she knows she's pregnant again. This is the life Willa wants. It feels a long way off from the life Willa presently has, the one where she's heartbroken and lost. Her mother is gone. 5 years from now, even if Willa has attained the kind of perfection she dreams of, Vivi will still be gone. She's gone forever. Willa will never see her again. It seems impossible. Someone snuffed out her life and then, in an act so unconscionable Willa can't even imagine it, drove away. Someone on this island got away with murder. Willa wants justice. There was a rumor going around that Cruz DeSantis had been the one to hit Vivi and was just pretending that he'd found her. But Willa refuses to entertain this possibility.
People are just gossiping, Willa says. They don't know Cruz like we do.
Rip isn't so sure.
I heard there are some funny things about his story. Even your brother thinks it might be him.
No, he doesn't, Willa says.
I think he does, Rip says. I guess Cruz and Leo had a fight the night before, so maybe Cruz came over so early because he was upset. And he turned on to Kingsley going too fast without paying attention, and boom.
Don't say boom.
Willa closes her eyes. She can't let herself imagine the moment of impact, but she can't block it out either.
It wasn't Cruz.
It was someone else.
Just keep checking with the police, please.
I want them to get this guy behind bars. Willa is 8 weeks pregnant, and although she has by now trained herself not to get her hopes up, she cannot lose this pregnancy. This is the last pregnancy Vivi knew about. This baby and Willa's mother were alive at the same time. This pregnancy must continue. It must thrive. Willa doesn't feel sick or tired or dizzy. Her breasts might be a bit tender, but that could be because she's constantly pressing and pinching them to see if they feel tender.
I cannot lose this baby. I cannot lose this baby.
Willa knows she's obsessing, and that obsessing is bad for her. She obsesses about obsessing. Moving into Wee Bit is a good distraction. Willa does her favorite thing. She makes a list. She writes down all the essentials they need to bring and checks them off as she packs them up. 5 linen dresses for work, t-shirts, her short overalls, 5 bathing suits, her straw hat, her Lululemon shorts, and tanks for exercising, which she is going to do more often. And a cotton open weave sweater because it gets chilly at night by the ocean. Wee Bit has a sandy front yard separated from the entrance to Smith's Point by a split rail fence. Up over the rise is the prettiest stretch of beach on Nantucket, a wide swath of golden sand as far as the eye can see, blue-green water, gentle waves. On her first afternoon at Wee Bit, Willa goes for a barefoot walk at the waterline. She's the only person on the beach. It feels like she has the entire island to herself. Because she works at the Nantucket Historical Association, she can't help but think of all the lives and stories that have played out on this island. She's a native. This land, in some sense, belongs to her. She picks up her pace until her heart rate increases. Blood flow is good for the baby. So is fresh air, sunshine. Can these things combat her indescribable grief?
Mom, she thinks, where are you? Where did you go?
The waves encroach and recede over and over again, just as they did hundreds of years ago when the Wampanoag tribe swam in these waters. In the 1860s, during the height of the whaling industry. In the 1920s, when artists and actors from New York came to Nantucket to escape the heat of the city. The waves will keep rolling in and out for all eternity, long after Willa is gone. After her children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren are gone, Willa feels dizzy. When she heads back to Wee Bit, it's 6:30, and despite her fantasy of a life where everything is made from scratch, she can't manage anything more complicated than peanut butter crackers. Millie's, a Mexican restaurant, is a short bike ride away, and Willa is craving their guacamole. This is a good sign, she thinks. She has lost 4 pounds since her mother died. As she comes up over the rise, she blinks. There's a red Range Rover parked alongside the split rail fence. Pamela's car.
What is she doing here? Willa wonders.
Pamela and Zach made a bet about how long Willa and Rip would last out in Smith's Point.
Zach gives it a week, Pamela said. I give it 2 days. Is she here to check?
The only downside to marrying Rip Bonham is having Pamela Bonham Bridgman. She likes to refer to herself by all three names as a sister-in-law. Willa despises her. Willa has always despised her. Pamela is 16 years older than Rip. Mrs. Bonham, Tink, suffered three miscarriages, which is the number Willa rests at presently. But Tink was bound and determined to give birth to an heir. Wasn't Pamela an heir? Yes, technically, but male primogeniture reigned supreme in the Bonham household. As Willa had learned from studying so many of Nantucket's family trees, if Tink hadn't given birth to Rip, the Bonham name would have splintered off into a distaff Bridgman line. But Tink had, at last, been successful, and on March 11, 1997, she gave birth to a 10-pound baby boy. Pamela, at the time a sophomore in boarding school, had both doted on and greatly resented Rip, and she has vacillated between love and bitterness ever since. She probably sensed that her own presence in the family wasn't enough, and this left a permanent chip on her shoulder. She's prickly, tough, difficult to please. Pamela has never been a fan of Willa's and huffs in disbelief with each passing year that Willa and Rip stay together. While Rip was at Amherst College, Pamela encouraged him to date girls from Smith and Holyoke. When Rip proposed to Willa, Pamela launched a campaign to make him reconsider. She said she didn't want Rip to limit himself. Pamela didn't think Willa was good enough. Willa was the product of a broken home. She had needed 3 years of orthodonture. She didn't ski. She wasn't competitive in games like the Bonhams were. Her political views were too far left. She was bookish, bordering on antisocial. The list of objections went on and on. There had been moments when Willa was certain Rip would submit to his sister and ask for his ring back. He held his sister in the highest regard. Both of them now worked together at the family insurance company under Chaz. Pamela was vice president of homeowners insurance, while Rip handled claims. Pamela was smart, savvy, decisive, and strategic about how to grow the business beyond what her great-great-grandfather could ever have dreamed of. Willa had to hear about her genius incessantly. But Rip had stuck to his guns, as the saying went. Pamela wore black to the wedding, and Willa accepted Pamela as the burden she must bear for the treasure that was her new husband. Lots of people had trouble with their in-laws. Willa was hardly alone in this. Willa reminds herself that Pamela's life is hardly perfect. There's a good chance that Pamela's ill will toward Willa is stoked by jealousy. Pamela's husband, Zach, the head of air traffic control at Nantucket Memorial, is way more handsome than Pamela is pretty. Their looks are so uneven that it brings up questions, the first one being, how did they get together? Willa knows the answer. Zach waited tables at the Field and Oar Club in the summer of 1999, and Pamela was so smitten by him that she walked right into the help's quarters one night and asked him out. Zach is also cool and funny. He reads for pleasure, including all of Vivi's books, and he's a licensed pilot in addition to being the head of ATC. Willa likes Zach tremendously. Having him around balances out the unpleasantness of Pamela. Their son, Peter, looks like Zach. He's a handsome kid, but he has inherited Pamela's temperament. He's a jerk. Sorry, but he is. He has always been a jerk. Back when Willa and Rip used to babysit Peter, they were constantly doing damage control. Peter was a biter and a toy stealer and a sand thrower, and no amount of reprimands or timeouts ever changed his behavior. In school, he was diagnosed with ADHD, put on Adderall, taken off Adderall, sent to Proctor Academy his sophomore year, kicked out of Proctor for smoking and selling weed, then sent back to Nantucket High School. He had to repeat a grade, which put him in the same class as Leo. Leo loathed Peter. "I know he's sort of family," Leo said, "but he's a prick." Willa can't imagine why Pamela is out here in Smith's Point. She never stopped by the house at Quaker Road, and that was infinitely closer.
Hi? Willa says. Pamela is still in the rover, but her window is down. She's typing something on her phone. Everything okay? Pamela looks up. Fine. Okay, Willa says. Is this a social visit then? It's a stunning evening, filled with the mellow, golden light of early summer. Do you want a tour? It looks a lot better. Not right now, Pamela says. She offers Willa a rare smile. How are you feeling? Willa isn't sure what Pamela is asking. Is she talking about Willa's earth-shattering loss? Or about her pregnancy? Rip told his sister that Willa was pregnant again, which was sort of fine, except Pamela then went and shared the news with the elder Bonhams, and so now Tink and Chas are treating Willa like she's made of bone china. Their desire to pass along the family name has grown only more fervent with time. Willa hasn't told her brother and sister, her father, or even Savannah that she's pregnant. She's going to wait until after she gets her ultrasound, which is in another 6 weeks. I'm okay, I guess, Willa says, not eating, not sleeping. I was glad to move out here. Pamela sniffs. It's quiet anyway. Peaceful. Willa nods, wondering what Pamela wants. Maybe she's just checking in. Maybe she feels bad for Willa and intends to offer herself as a mother substitute. The idea is nearly laughable. You're sure you don't want to come in? Willa says. I wish I had something other than tap water to offer you. I think Rip and I are just going to get takeout from Millie's. I can't handle the grocery store yet. Too many people. Their eyes give them away. I know they feel sorry for me. Some of them come up and offer their sympathies. Others wave and say hello like everything is normal. Pamela looks at Willa, and an amazing thing happens. Pamela's eyes fill with tears. Pamela Bonham Bridgman is displaying human emotion. Willa tries to abandon her cynicism. Had Pamela liked Vivi? Admired her, maybe? Willa remembers no special connection. Pamela habitually referred to Vivi's books as fluff and always seemed a little pissed off that her husband was such a fan. If I share something with you, do you promise not to tell anyone? Pamela says. Even Rip? What is this? Willa thinks. A confidence? A secret? Willa's mind starts racing. What is happening here? Is Willa's dream for the past 12 years, half her life, of having a normal relationship with her sister-in-law finally coming true? Of course, Willa says. She isn't sure she'll be able to keep whatever this is from Rip, but she'll try. I think Zach is having an affair, Pamela says. Willa feels a surge of what she can only describe as lurid excitement. Though she's aghast, too, of course. In fact, I'm sure he is, Pamela says. Vivi. This is getting good, Vivi says. She has pulled one of the peach silk souffle chairs right up to the edge of the room. We need popcorn. She tilts her head. Why isn't there food up here? Why isn't there wine? Heavenly banquet. Martha says, once you join the choir. Only then? Reward for all that singing. Will there be truffle fries? Vivi asks. Tequila? Vivian, please. Martha says, let's focus on the matter at hand. The matter at hand. Pamela thinks Zach is having an affair. Vivi knows she should be more sympathetic toward Pamela. After all, Vivi has been in the exact same spot, except Vivi didn't have to figure it out. JP had marched into the house one late summer evening and told Vivi he'd fallen for Amy, sounding almost proud of himself. But Pamela is an unsympathetic character in this story. If Vivi were still alive and Willa had confided Pamela's suspicions about Zach to Vivi, Vivi might have said, good for him. Vivi is an absolutely wretched person. How did she end up ascending instead of descending? Martha chuckles. She's an unapologetic mind reader. Is there more? Vivi asks.
Martha pulls the second souffle chair up next to Vivi's. Oh, there's more.
Carson.
The owner of the oyster catcher gives her 2 weeks off after her mother dies, but then she has to make a decision. Return to work or quit. It's the 4th of July weekend. The oyster catcher is pumping, and they need their bartender. The owner, George, has been subbing in, but if Carson doesn't return for her weekend shifts, he'll have no choice but to replace her. She shows up on Saturday at 3 o'clock, right before Buckashuck. George puts his hands on her shoulders.
You can do this.
He sounds like he's sending her out into the ring with Floyd Mayweather.
I can totally do this.
Before Carson left her mother's house, she made herself a double espresso and did a shot of her mother's tequila, which Savannah had found in the laundry room.
I figured your mom would hide it someplace you would never look, Savannah said.
Carson steps behind the bar and jumps right in. A dozen Island Creeks, a dozen Cherry Stones, 4 Whale's Tail Pale Ale Drafts, vodka soda, close it, for the Chad in the pink polo shirt, a dozen East Beach Blondes, 2 Chardonnays, a Planter's Punch. Carson fields the orders like they're pop flies. She won't think about her mother. She won't check her phone. When she gets a second to breathe, she makes herself an espresso and takes an Ativan. She can do this. The crowd thickens with every passing minute. It's like eating a plate of spaghetti. You think you're making headway, but you can't clean your plate. Maybe that's the Ativan talking? No, there are people pouring in, drawn to the bar like iron shavings to a magnet. Sean Lee, the guitar player, starts singing, and Carson curses herself because she meant to request Stone in Love by Journey. Sean had sent her a text saying, if there's anything I can do, let me know. And Carson texted back and asked him to learn this song because, it turns out, this is the song that Vivi was listening to when she got hit. Burning love comes once in a lifetime. Carson could tell from looking at Vivi's phone that she had gotten Carson's last text.
Sorry about the pan, Mama. And the tequila wasn't me. I love you.
The timing of the text was so close to what the police said was the point of impact that Carson wondered if Vivi had been reading her text instead of watching the road, and that Carson's apology was the reason her mother was killed.
You'll be the death of me, Carson Marie.
Savannah assured Carson that the place where the police found the phone indicated that the phone had not been held in front of Vivi's face, but rather at her side. Was Savannah making that up? It was possible, but Carson clung to the maybe a lie like a life buoy. She couldn't take another breath otherwise. By 7 o'clock, as the sun is starting to slant toward its descent, the oyster catcher is at maximum capacity, and all the customers are deliriously happy, eating, drinking, taking selfies, singing along with Sean, talking and laughing as though nothing bad could ever happen. As though they were all going to live forever. Carson gets lots of tips, but she can't bring herself to ring the damn bell. It feels like a button that's out of her reach, a bar she can't clear. She asks the kiss-ass barback, Jamie, boy, to cover while she goes to the bathroom. She needs something. The Ativan took the edge off, but the downside is she's in a fog. She has some Coke, but she isn't sure how it will mix with her grief. Still, she's back at work. She needs to be up, up, up. She's only halfway through her shift. She taps some out on her thumb, snorts. Ah, okay. Her eyes water. It's bitter, sharp. She sits on the toilet waiting for the rush, but it's slow to come, so she bumps. She feels her heart kickstart. Great. She's back in the game. She reaches into her purse for her phone, which might as well be radioactively glowing. Don't touch it, she thinks. She touches it. Has he texted? Yes, he has. She hasn't heard from him since the day her mother died. That night, she sent him 2 texts. The first said, I can't do this anymore.
The second said, "Please don't come to the service. Say you're sick or you have to work, I don't care, but please do not show your face at the church or the reception." Immediately after she sent the texts, she wanted to snatch them back because she was hurting and she needed him. But the affair had to end, because how was Carson to know that Vivi's death wasn't the universe's way of punishing her? When Carson talked to Savannah about this, "Do you think Mom died because of something I did?" Savannah took Carson's cheeks between her palms and squished them together so that Carson had fish lips, something she used to do when Carson was little. "It was an accident, baby. A senseless accident. It didn't have anything to do with you or me or even Vivi herself." This sounded rational, and even like something Vivi might say in her sweet, tart way. "Not everything is about you, darling." But she couldn't be sure, and Savannah didn't know the depths of Carson's treachery. Carson washes her hands and checks her reflection in the mirror. Her green eyes flash wickedly. That's from the blow. Her cheeks have color. She looks better. She feels better. She can do this. She goes back to work.
"Mount Gay and Tonic. Strong, please, bruh."
This is from a young guy in the corner seat. Carson rolls her eyes. "All my drinks are strong."
"That was a joke," the guy says. "Because of last week? At your—"
He stops suddenly.
"Never mind. Mount Gay and Tonic, regular strength is fine."
Carson narrows her eyes at him. He's cute if you like golfers and preppies. His golden blonde hair is a little long in the back and curls up under his baseball cap. "Ducks," the cap says on the front. And he has a strong chin, which Carson likes. What does he mean, last week? She makes him a drink using a little more rum than she might normally. And when she sets the glass down, it dawns on her that she has gone only one place. The field and ore?
"Yes," he says. "I'm Marshall. I bartend there. I'm really sorry about your mom."
Carson isn't sure how to react. She didn't anticipate being faced with anyone here who knew about her mom. Her customers are primarily tourists, day trippers, hotel guests, Airbnb dwellers, renters, summer residents. The locals stopped coming once the 2-hour wait for a table started a few weeks ago. Carson decides to smile through her agonizing pain. Her mother is dead. How can she be standing here? "Thank you," she says. "I appreciate it." Marshall takes a sip of his Mount Gay, then asks for a menu. "Are you waiting for someone?" Carson asks. He looks up at her with an expression that is both alarmed and embarrassed, and she feels like a jerk for asking. She reaches into her bag under the bar and pulls out her phone. Nothing for nearly a week, and now there are 2 texts from him. She clicks on her camera and turns around to snap a selfie with Marshall. He grins, and the picture is cute, so she posts it to her Instagram with the caption, "Taking care of Marshall from the hashtag Field and Ore Club on his night off." Wink emoji. A dozen Island Creeks, 4 Bud Lights, 2 dirty martinis, and then 3 tables orders come into the service bar, and Carson regrets taking the 30 seconds to post because now she's in the weeds. When she finally pops her head above water, Marshall says he wants to order dinner, the fish sando, extra tartar, and fries and coleslaw, and the chowder to start. Carson gives him a second Mount Gay and Tonic on the house. She's hitting the top of her high now. Nothing can stop her. She's moving like lightning, shaking up martinis and cosmos, joking with the couple on the far left side of the bar, pounding some high fives, delivering platters of oysters and clams, extra lemon, extra horseradish, extra crackers. "You're on fire," Marshall says. "Is it always like this?"
"Always,"
Carson says, though she's showing off. She knows what Marshall's bartending job at the club looks like. It's making cocktails for Carson's grandmother and Penny Rosen when they arrive at 4:30 for dinner, and pulling draft beers for New York investment bankers after they come off the tennis court. Marshall's food is up, and Carson takes extra care in setting down the plate. Fish sando, extra tartar, fries and slaw. What else can I get you?
I never saw the chowder, he says.
Oh, wait. Carson checks the slip. She forgot to put in the chowder. How is this possible?
I forgot to put it in. I am so sorry.
She feels like a fraud. She isn't such a superstar after all. She's a crummy server.
Don't worry about it, he says. This looks great.
Carson hesitates. Let me put it in, please. I feel awful.
What if you let me buy you a drink when you get off tonight? He says. You finish around 11? We can hit the back bar at Ventuno.
Carson nearly laughs. He's asking her out? Marshall from the Field and Ore?
Oh, how cute. He's probably a year or two older than she is, but she knows she would eat him alive.
Ducks means the University of Oregon. This comes to Carson out of nowhere. He's fresh and piney like the Pacific Northwest.
Let me see how I'm feeling, okay?
Whatever works.
Marshall stares down at his plate, and Carson can tell he's stung. He put himself out there and she turned him down, and he doesn't have any other friends. Or if he does, they're all working at the Field and Ore.
I'll let you know before you finish eating, Carson says.
She flags the other bar back, Jamie, who is a girl and not a kiss-ass, to cover her, grabs her bag, and goes to the bathroom. She takes one bump, then another. Tomorrow, she'll have to call her guy. She needs to get back out there and finish the dinner rush strong, but she sees her phone and it's like falling into a hole. She checks her texts.
Can I see you tonight? End of Kingsley? We should probably talk.
Carson's head pitches forward. She loves her phone so much in that moment that she'd like to take a bite of it. These texts are like cool water on a bad sunburn, like a soft pillow when she can't keep her eyes open, a balm, a relief. He wants to see her. She sends back a text.
No.
She counts to 10, which is all it takes for three dots to appear, and then,
I can't go another day without seeing you. Meet me, please.
She hesitates. Giddiness bubbles up inside her. She's a shaken can of seltzer about to spew. But no, it has to end. While it's still a secret, they have done enough damage. Her mother is dead.
Okay, she texts back. See you at midnight.
Carson heads back out to the bar. Marshall finished his dinner, and Jamie has gotten him a fresh drink.
I can't meet you tonight, Carson says, but maybe another time. And hey, your dinner is on me.
She takes his tab and slips it into her apron pocket.
There's no need.
Oh, but there is. She winks at him. We have to take care of each other.
She heads to the other side of the bar to take orders. When she comes back, Marshall is gone. A $50 bill and a napkin with his phone number are in his place. Carson shakes her head. Bold move. She likes it. She throws the napkin away, tosses the 50 in the bucket, and rings the bell. Midnight finds her in cutoffs and Chuck Taylors walking down Kingsley toward the dead end. There's a space in the bushes big enough, almost, to hide one car, and that's where Zach Bridgman is waiting for her in his Audi Q7. She climbs into the back seat with him, and when she sees him, smells him. He smoked a cigarette on the way over, another secret he keeps from his wife. She starts to cry. He gently takes her face in his hands and licks her tears, and then they're kissing like it's the only thing keeping them alive. Carson wants to straddle his lap. She wants to wriggle out of her shorts or even rip them in half to get them off. She wants to slide down on top of him and bounce up and down, his hands grasping her ass until they both climax in a burst of heat and light. But instead, she pulls away. She's dead.
I know, baby. I'm so sorry.
And I have nobody to hold me.
I'll hold you.
This is our fault.
He flinches at this, as she knew he would. Zach refuses to acknowledge the dark side of what they're doing. All he ever talks about is how happy Carson makes him
how his life has new meaning, how each day is filled with possibility instead of despair. He's the one who's married. He's the one who has to lie, sneak out, delete everything on his phone. But he would never accept that their union was evil enough to bring about this kind of retribution.
Don't be ridiculous, Carson. Our relationship has nothing to do with your mother.
I believe otherwise. You can tell me I'm wrong, but you can't prove I'm wrong.
I came to the surface, Zach says. I was in the back. I could only see the side of your face, but I was there. I cut out of work. I left Yates in charge, which was irresponsible, but I needed to see you, if only from afar.
He does this all the time, speaks like he's writing a sonnet, if only from afar. I specifically asked you not to come. I don't know why you think I would be happy to hear you came anyway. Zach sighs, rests his head against the seat. His skin is pale and beautiful in the dark. He has long, thick eyelashes and a few gray hairs around his ears. She is 21 years old, and her lover has gray hair. But his age is third or fourth down the list of what makes him inappropriate. Let's say what we're doing has nothing to do with my mother's death. There's still no good ending to this. Only destructive, scandalous endings. We need to walk away tonight and never speak of it again.
What about the ending where I leave Pamela and we run away together? Hawaii, Alaska, Paris. I can find work anywhere. So can you. Peter is going off to college in 8 weeks. Can't we hang on for 8 weeks?
We would still destroy two families, yours and what's left of mine. It has to end, Zach. She forces the words out. She doesn't want it to end. She wants Alaska, Hawaii, Paris, however improbable that sounds. I had a very handsome man ask me out at work. He lives here. He's single. He's closer to my age.
Zach closes his eyes. Yes, I saw your Instagram.
Well, that was why she'd posted it, wasn't it? Carson doesn't care a whit about her social media, except as a way of agitating Zach. Carson kisses Zach's cheek and opens her door. I'll see you at the next family gathering. She closes the door gently but firmly and starts walking down the dirt road to her house. She hears one door open and close, then another. He's moving to the front seat. The engine starts up. She wills him to drive right past her. But if he does, she knows tonight will end with her leaving him desperate voicemails, and in the final one, she'll threaten to tell Pamela everything if he doesn't meet her again tomorrow. The car slows down. She hears the electric hum of his window.
You know, I can't live without you, and I can't stand the thought of anyone else touching you.
She keeps walking. She wants to be with him, but it's wrong. So wrong that her mother is now dead.
Carson,
he whispers. It's risky for them to